And now to the aliens came from outer space.
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News. At 20 minutes before 8 Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars.
Have you ever been alone in the house, even in the daytime, but especially at night, and you've heard a sound and you can't get it out of your head? There shouldn't have been that noise downstairs or at the back of the house or in the garden. Is someone there? Sound is magnificent. It can convey so much. One of the best examples of how voice and sound can scare the hell out of you was Orson Welles in War of the Worlds. Now, I know somebody who knows a lot about that, Benjamin Nadav-Hafri. He writes on American history, technology, media and music, and he lives in New York City, and he's joining us now. Benjamin Nadav-Hafri, welcome to Counterpoint.
Thank you for having me on.
Have you ever had hell scared out of you in the middle of the night by a sound that you didn't expect?
Oh, God. I mean, all the time when I was a kid, for sure. Unfortunately, I don't listen to that many radio plays in the state in the middle of the night, so it doesn't happen to me the way it did for War of the Worlds listeners.
What's the story with War of the Worlds?
Well, there are actually two stories with it. The one is the legend that's extremely popular in the States especially, and the other is the new understanding that's emerging around the broadcast. But the sort of banner blockbuster story of War of the Worlds is this. On October 30th, 1938, a man named Orson Welles, the very famous actor later in film but then in radio, put on a radio play as part of his first-person singular program, which aired every Sunday night on CBS. And it wasn't even a very popular radio play. But the legend of the night is that there was a much more popular radio show going on at the same time, the Charlie McCarthy Show, and that at just the right moment in Orson Welles' radio play, Charlie McCarthy had just a terrible act on his show, and people started twiddling the dial. And they landed on something that sounded to them like a music program. There was someone named Raymond Raquello who was playing in New York City. And then over the course of the first 10 minutes or so of this broadcast, there were these breaking news bulletins that cut into the musical program. So first there was word of the fact that there had been some explosions seen off Mars, and later it becomes this going concern with CBS that they have to kind of get you to the scene so you can understand more about these explosions from Mars. A radio reporter, Carl Phillips, takes you to Professor Pearson's office, a professor at Princeton who's an astronomer, and explains a little bit about what he thinks is going on with Mars. And while you're in Professor Pearson's office, seemingly still listening to this music show that's suddenly become about these bizarre cosmic happenings. And when the radio reporter Carl Phillips is in Professor Pearson's office, Pearson sort of dismisses as mere coincidence the fact that not too long after these explosions happened off on Mars, a large meteor landed on somebody's farm in New Jersey. And later, Pearson and Phillips go to that farm and witness as that meteor actually turns out to be an extraterrestrial craft carrying these Martians who annihilate everybody on the scene around them. And then over the course of this broadcast that some listeners apparently still thought was supposed to be a music show, you hear as the aliens wreak havoc across Earth, but you hear it through radio shows. And this is the important part, is that it's not just like you're hearing the Martians wreak havoc as you would in a classic radio play. You're hearing the Brigadier General taking to the airwaves to declare some counties in New Jersey are going to be put under martial law. Or you're hearing the Secretary of the Interior talking about maintaining human supremacy on the Earth. And you're hearing shortwave radio operators calling out to each other over the air. And it just feels like the whole apparatus, it's falling apart. As you listen to it, society is crumbling and you're hearing it on the radio. And this, of course, was not actually going on. It was just Orson Welles' Halloween offering from First Person Singular. And whether or not he meant it at the time to scare people is still up for debate. He initially claimed that it wasn't intended that way. Of course, he and CBS were under a lot of fire for the effect that their broadcast had. But In later years, he reversed and said that, you know, that maybe it was intended to terrify people. But the news the next day was convinced that it was a national emergency that had transpired because of this radio play. It was said that the New York Times had gotten all of these calls from people wanting news about it. It was reported somewhere that a Rhode Island electricity company had been told to shut down power so that the Martians might overlook the darkened city. The New Jersey Bell Telephone Company reportedly got between 75,000 and 100,000 calls. Some people were said to have died from fear. And whether or not this is true, it's actually really hard to say. But this is the popular imagination of the evening, is that over a million people panicked because of this radio play. And that's formed a lot of the understanding we have now about media and new technologies and fears about what they can do to our minds.
Sure. Well, I read another article on this, and apparently in Maine there was a headline, Maine refused to get excited, because what their reporters did was hear some of this sort of stuff and did a quick survey of telephoning 50 or 100 people round about, and not many people had actually listened. And apparently when Princeton University analysed a whole lot of this stuff, they couldn't actually find much more than 6 or 7 real interviews with people who actually said they were terrified. In other words, some research shows that this is just a big cook-up.
And that's kind of a perfect segue into what some people think about War of the Worlds now. There's a scholar, Michael Sokolow, who writes a lot about this. And just as you say, there are a lot of newspaper reports from right after the event that are convinced that people all over the country were panicking. But one of the key pieces of evidence in that popular understanding is a book called The Invasion from Mars by a man named Hadley Cantrell. And that book is where the over a million number comes from. And what's interesting about Hadley Cantrell is he was based in Princeton at the Office of Radio Research, and he did the big study on War of the Worlds. But various scholars have shown that his analysis and his polls were done in such a way that he was drawing his conclusions sort of before the evidence actually showed what he was going to conclude. But it was, in some ways, it's just too good a story to pass up. It was good for the newspapers. It was good for social psychologists who wanted to convince the country that they had a meaningful stake in the country's well-being in advance of the war. And of course, it was good for Orson Welles, who is a huge ham and loved to tell stories like this across his lifetime. But yeah, one of the major theories about this is that over the course of the 1930s, especially, radio became a more trusted source of news than the newspapers. And so some feel that newspapers had a vested interest in proving that radio was not to be trusted. And one of the ways they were going to do this is by emphasizing this story of a time when radio really let people down. And, you know, CBS was aware enough of that risk that they said they wouldn't do any more simulated news broadcasts after that. And it was really a moment where the way we had of knowing about the world was changing from print to radio. People were trying to navigate that change. And this is just one of those moments that was a real flashpoint in showing how that change affected people.
Radio can be very, very powerful, especially in elections. I mean, at any time, as War of the Worlds may or may not show, the stuff I've read shows that really the million thing is a huge beat up, that it just didn't happen like that. But in any event, in politics, it can be extremely powerful. You can have the print media and television saying one thing, but if that's not what people are hearing on radio, on talkback radio, it's not necessarily what's going to happen. And there was an example of that in the United States, wasn't there, with Franklin Roosevelt?
Yes, the famous fireside chats that made millions across America feel close to the president in a way they never had. And what's interesting about that, too, is Roosevelt, in 1936, when he was up for re-election, was opposed by a significant number of newspapers in America, but he still won in a landslide. And at least one interpretation, according to a book about the 1930s by a historian named William Stott, is that it was a sort of vindictive voting against the newspapers that was taking place, that people were asserting their own freedom of choice and freedom from what the newspapers were telling them to do by voting for Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And he, of course, he was the radio president.
Well, I don't think that message has been forgotten on any politician, frankly. Talking directly to the people is a good thing. Have you read many accounts of the coverage of the response to the play being both racist and sexist, in that there were many stories about African Americans being terrified, lots of stories focusing on Harlem more than anywhere else, and also stories about women and children were terrified, sort of suggesting that, you know, no man hopped in his car and tried to drive out of the city.
Yeah, so I haven't actually seen as many stories about Harlem as you're suggesting, though. That definitely checks out. I mean, the argument about women and children being more terrified is certainly the case in what I've seen. There's another historian, David Goodman, who has a book called Radio Civic Ambition. And what he does is he situates the concern about War of the Worlds in this broader context about the intelligence of the listening public. So there was this concern, especially with what was going on in Nazi Germany in the late 1930s, with whether or not people, citizens and democracies, were really smart enough to think critically about what they were hearing on the radio. And of course, there's a lot of people then and now who would be quick to assume that certain kinds of people, certain demographics, are less capable of doing that than others. And, you know, stories will seek to confirm that bias.
I'm talking with Benjamin Nadav Heffery about how sound, radio, can scare the hell out of you. And more importantly, how do you know when you hear something or read something that it's really true? One of the strengths, I think, of radio is that when you hear a person's voice, a human's voice, you can hear the emotion in it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some speech writers can write a fabulous speech that can really touch someone's heart, but not many are really that good. Whereas radio does allow that very aspect of humanity to come through, doesn't it? And that makes it powerful as well.
I completely agree. These days you hear all the time about various media disappearing or succumbing to the internet. And it's sort of crazy when you think about it that radio is still around and as popular as it is. And I think it's precisely because the voice just invites your imagination in, makes room for listeners' engagement with a story and a person and a whole emotional dimension and world in a way that print doesn't always. And I think that's just sort of a instinctively powerful thing about the medium. And that's why it's so scary, too.
Do you know, I don't think, from what I hear, that Donald Trump has read the article in the Washington Post about radio and the War of the Worlds, nor your article, because I think he thinks he's the first one to come up with fake news.
A friend of mine, when I was working on the article, actually sent me a paper written by Brian Cowan, a historical essay, and it included this fact about a 17th century concern that coffee houses were going to create false news or help spread false news. And, you know, I don't know if it was because the caffeine was going to overstimulate people. It was just this idea that this wholly new place where people were going to be exchanging information was going to produce something disruptive that was going to throw people off the truth. And certainly, undermining the press is, of course, something that historically has been done in countries that are leaning fascist. You know, I'm not commenting on what's happening.
No, I'm not passing conversation, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. I hadn't heard the story about the coffee houses. That's hundreds of years ago, so nothing's new, they say.
Yeah, exactly. There's nothing new under the sun.
Yeah.
People use that argument that nothing is new to suggest that nothing should be taken seriously sometimes. I've heard some people say things like, well, we've been through what we're going through now with the internet, with radio before, so why should we worry about it? It'll pass. But I think to say that it's happened before is not to say that it doesn't matter or that it's not destabilizing or it can't be significant in some way to our understanding of the world. It's just to say that these things can come and go, but they have to be navigated with care, these sort of epistemological crises.
Yeah. I mentioned earlier the headline, Maine refused to get excited. Apparently, that headline only came to light to researchers looking at the impact of this play because somebody had gone and digitized all of the papers of that time and made them available online. And without that, we wouldn't know now that this paper and presumably lots of other little papers around the United States that basically said, look, this is a joke. It didn't happen here. And surveys now show that apparently only 2% of Americans were listening to the damn thing.
Well, and that's where the idea, though, about the bad segment on the Charlie McCarthy show comes into play, because you couldn't know precisely how many people were listening. So, of course, it's possible that many people twiddled. But I'm compelled by the idea that I do think that some people were panicked. I mean, there's enough firsthand accounts of people panicking. And I certainly don't think Hadley Cantrell fabricated some of the interviews he did. But I'm compelled by the work that various historians have done showing that the panic wasn't nearly as extensive as was reported
at
the time. But what's so interesting about it is that it's not something that we can know, really. And in some ways, the story about War of the Worlds really just instantiates the thing that was supposedly being proven that night. Just what can you actually know? And the further out we get from it, the harder it is to really know
what is true.
What is true? Did people panic that night? I mean, the tape of the original night, supposedly the original broadcast, which is, you know, in the Library of Congress and everything like that. But saying that because the cops were beating down the door of the studio, Orson Welles had destroyed the tape of the War of the Worlds. And there actually is no such thing as the original War of the Worlds broadcast. It was actually recreated a week later. And that's what everybody thinks now is the original. And
Benjamin, this is terrible. The story goes on and on. Fake news, fake news, fake news. It's everywhere. And how do you know what is real? I mean, how would you know that you were listening to a recreated War of the Worlds? I wouldn't know if I listened to it on the radio, only because you've just told me now. Benjamin Nadav-Heffery, what I think we've learned is that you really have to be skeptical about what's real. Even if you hear it and you think it's live, it might not be. And I think that's also taught us the power of radio. So now we've got, fortunately, listeners who, if they weren't skeptical before, now will be, and who will understand the power of radio. Thanks very much for joining us, Benjamin Nadav-Heffery.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, that's it for this week. Thanks for joining us. Please join us next week. If you've got a comment to make, go to the ABC website, go to Radio National, to programs, follow the prompts to Counterpoint and tell us what you think. To take us out this week, this is really great. Listen to this. From 1978, Jeff Wayne's pop opera, and this is Eve of the War. The chances of anything coming from Mars are millions to one, but still